Peter's denial, King of the Jews, crowd demands crucifixion, soldiers persecute Jesus, Jesus' crucifixion, the centurion's confession, women from afar, and Jesus' burial. Now what we want to do here today is to focus on let me ask, first of all, since we will not come back to this matter for this semester, do you have any questions about this matter of paragraph titles, which I think is a very helpful device both for you in your study and also in use with people in churches or other ministerial situations? Do you have any questions about this process? I hope you've learned now that there's plenty of room for variety in this kind of thing. It's an individual matter, last analysis. You've probably learned that in what you've seen in different terms always put on the board here and what you've done. All right, we want to focus then on on three other aspects of looking at segments as wholes, namely getting at the primary laws of structure in the segment as a whole, asking questions about each of these, and then focusing on some strategic areas. As far as the matter of literary form, obviously the literary form here is prose narrative. There's no great problem there. And we won't worry about the other impressions. They probably come through anyway as we talk about this. So let's begin focusing then on the primary laws of structure and the questions on each of these laws that need to be asked in order to get the meaning of the observation of these laws in the segment as a whole. And what I'll do is to ask various ones of you to offer some suggestions, and we'll talk about them insofar as we have time, and in the process try to get before us the main relationships. Dennis Mode, I wonder if you would start out by giving at least one primary law you found operative.
The first one I thought that I found was preparation and utilization. I thought I found that in chapter 14, verses 1 and 2. It sort of set the pace for all the rest that was to follow. Not everything deals directly with the scribes and priests, but it deals with his soon and imminent death, what's going to happen. And I wasn't quite sure. I left a big question mark at 15, in chapter 15, whether verses 1 through 5 was another preparation, and then what followed the utilization of it.
All right, your first one is virtually predictable. It's been done time and time again by classes. Let's look at that, because on the surface of it, it does look like preparation for the rest of the material. But you've given one reason already why one might raise a question about it, namely that the whole thing is not about the actual crucifixion of Jesus. You have some other factors involved here, including, for example, Jesus observing the Passover with his disciples, among other things. But there are several other reasons why one might question whether you have really here a preparatory statement which is then realized, or whether you have here, on the other hand, the first in a series of steps, causal steps leading to the crucifixion. Now, what strikes me really is the element of contrast here as between what was plotted by the chief priests and scribes and what really happened, which is really the very opposite of preparation and realization. Because what they plotted was to arrest him by stealth and kill him, not during the feast. Well, now, what really happened? Was he killed during the feast and this whole thing happened by stealth? Or rather publicly? I think the answer is obvious, isn't it? Which really means that certain events took place in spite of and in contrast to this beginning of this process of plotting the crucifixion of Christ. particularly with regard to the timing of it. Now, the New Testament makes a great deal of that timing, because, of course, Christ died during the Passover feast, which is what they didn't want to happen. And the New Testament interprets, therefore, Jesus' death in terms of his being the Paschal Lamb. The fourth gospel probably makes a great deal of this in terms of its use of lamb terminology. Behold the Lamb of God that takes away the sin of the world. By the way, Paul makes a great deal of this by way of interpreting Jesus as the Paschal Lamb. So what you have in the tradition really here is an indication of a contrast as between what the chief priests and scribes thought they were going to do and what happened in spite of their planning. Now, as far as the thought to arrest him and kill him, that may well be the first in a whole stage of events, a whole series of events, I should say, that set the stage for the crucifixion. But at the same time, as far as 15 is concerned, that would you might have that there, but that would be a somewhat minor kind of preparation and realization, I would say, involving just a very small part of the whole. But you might be said, and I'm not sure this is more recent, you might be said to have recurrence of this element of preparation and realization in a number of ways here. Excluding what we've just been talking about. Now let me ask first of all, do you understand what I'm saying here? Why I would question whether you have the preparation in 14:1-2 and then the rest of the passage is realization because of this element of contrast, which is contradictory really to preparation and realization, which involves comparison and similarity and fulfillment, which involves let me ask now the volunteers, did you find other preparations and realizations which bind these materials together? Carol?
I had the whole segment 14:1-32 as preparations for the realization of 14:43-15:47. Mm-hmm. And the reason for that is I found basically seven elements that were preparatory to the following. The woman anointment perfuming his body to death, Judas's plot to betray him, Passover feast is prepared.
All right, let's stop with that second one. Did you catch the first one? The preparation for the burial, and then of course the burial comes. In other words, you have preparation and realization as between this unit here and the burial here. And then you're talking about Judas, and actually you have preparation and realization even within the unit that you indicated as preparatory, because here you have Judas plotting the betrayal. And then Jesus predicts this betrayal that is being plotted here. This prepares you for this here. And then, of course, did you include the actual arrest here, which you have where you have the betrayal actually taking place, being realized, so that within this you have this Judas motif, which apparently is a very significant motif in the unit here in terms of preparation and realization. You follow me there? So that even within those units you have the element and this element involved. What others do you have?
I had the Passover feast is prepared with the idea that Christ is the Passover.
All right, you have the preparation for the Passover and then the actual keeping of the Passover, which in a way includes both of these two paragraphs here. This paragraph has special significance in that connection because of the eating of the Passover. He goes through this this ritual, which really transforms the Passover from a merely Jewish or Hebrew celebration to the beginning of the Christian celebration and the Christian institution, as we know. Now, by the way, before we forget it, this prepares you, which this is an interpretation, obviously, what's going to happen. This prepares you for the meaning of the crucifixion. And the meaning of this event, which fulfills this giving of his body and his blood. And we'll come back to that in terms of its significance. So you have that element too, in terms of preparation and realization. What other elements do you have?
I have the prophecy of the scattered sheep being fulfilled later on, the disciples leaving.
All right, and that really includes both the desertion of the disciples who end up fleeing, including this young man who leaves his clothes behind, who may well be the author of the Gospel, Mark. That's one of the real possibilities here, along with Peter's denial. So you have this foretelling. You have the element of prediction and realization, you see, here in a number of ways, and other elements as well. You have this realized here here in the arrest of Jesus when they all flee, we're told, and then that includes this young man who flees here, and then of course also in terms of the actual denial by Peter, which Jesus foresees. All right, anything else here in terms of preparation and realization? Involved in this whole story.
I just had one last one I wasn't sure of, and that is the prayer at Gethsemane, preparing Christ for the death of Paul.
All right. Whether that certainly does. Whether it involves only preparation, which would be included in it, or whether there's something more precise or specifically involved, that would be the question that could be raised. Because you may have a causal element involved here. That is to say, it was because Jesus made this decision here. This was part of this whole process. In spite of what was being done by the chief priests and scribes, etc., to bring this about, including Judas, their cohort, to bring this about, the impression you get is that Jesus had an option here. And had he not taken the option that he did, namely saying to his father, after having said to him, Father, all things are possible, nevertheless, not my will, but thy will be done, had he not taken that option of having the father's will done, even though it might conflict with his own will, that the cross would not have happened. So this could be part of a causal pattern. See, what brought about the cross, and that is here Jesus' commitment to the Father's will, even though there was a conflict between what he himself wanted in certain ways and what the Father wanted. And by the way, this Gethsemane experience is tremendously significant for understanding the crucifixion in terms of this contrast between, first of all, the request implicit in the statement, Father, all things are possible. If it be possible, let this cup pass from me. Especially in light of all else that has been said. And then the contrast as between what I will, not my will, but thy will be done, which indicates that there is this contrast, this conflict in a real sense between the wills of the two. We
talked about this in various connections. I think we've gotten into this aspect to some degree here in terms of certain desires that Jesus had, which were in conflict with the crucifixion event.
So that would be the question I would raise here, Charles. As I say, preparation. Here's one case where you have overlapping relationships, and the question is, which is the more precise and specific way of describing what the relationship is. Causes prepare you for effects, you see, so that preparation and causation tend to overlap. Okay, any other elements of preparation and realization? Well, you see how this is a rather dominant motif, including this prediction
realization motif involving the fact that Jesus foresaw what would happen, including, of course, his foreseeing the crucifixion, so that he was going into this whole thing with his eyes wide open, including the fact that he couldn't rely on his disciples for any support. Just a moment, we'll get into the possible meanings here, although our time is flying rather rapidly. Yes, Lois?
I know this would be a minor realization preparation, but I wondered within the paragraph preparing for the Passover, where he predicted what would happen and then it happened, I wonder if that would be significant for the disciples to realize that everything else he predicted would happen.
You're talking about this paragraph here.
Yes, in that paragraph.
Yes. Jesus told them what they ought to do, and in fact, what would happen, and it happened. Yes, there's that element within this paragraph too that supports, undergirds this whole motif that Jesus foresaw what would happen, and what he foresaw did actually happen. Now, there are other elements here too, as we've noted, but that's certainly a very significant element. Yes.
And it also that ecclesiastical trial and trial before trial that is in preparation.
Yes, there is an element of preparation and realization, although there again you might have a causal element involved as well, in that probably in view of what happened in the what we call the civil trial here with Pilate, that what happened here was really a consequence of what happened here. So there might be a causal element even beyond the preparation and realization here. Well, our time is going rapidly here, and if you know to cover the territory, we've got to move along, but I'd better hook up this microphone before I fall on the floor. Now, I wish we had the time to ask some questions, because I'd be interested in seeing what you would do with that particular aspect of things. But our time is slipping on us so fast here that we won't get at some others of these relationships, so I think we'll forego that. Let me put on the screen the basic questions that I would ask with regard to this element of recurrence of preparation and realization. I think in terms of the fullest asking of questions, when you have a law, it involves two components, as is true, preparation and realization. The best thing would be to ask questions about each component separately. Now, I haven't done that in the samples I've given you. I've sort of compressed the two, but the fullest way of doing it would be to take each of those separately. What's the meaning of each preparatory event? How does each prepare for what follows? Why were such preparations made? Why is preparation used recurringly by the author? Would be a question which focuses on the preparatory element. And then how are the preparations fulfilled? How do the preparations illuminate the realization? And vice versa. Why are the preparations fulfilled as they are? Why emphasize recurring fulfillment? And what are the full implications of the answers to the questions with regard to both components? Do you have any problems with asking these questions? The kinds, the sequence, etc. All right. Now, by the way, let me briefly indicate something of the significance of what will emerge as you begin answering these questions, because you won't be able to tackle this segment as a whole at all. One of the dominant elements here has to be the fact that Jesus faced the crucifixion fully aware of what would happen. This is not a matter of accident. He didn't stumble into it. His eyes were fully open, even with regard to this inner circle, including the betrayal by Judas and the desertion of the rest of the disciples and Peter's denial. Now, that gives the crucifixion a significance it would not otherwise have. If
Jesus was not aware of what was going on here, you see. Or if Jesus was not genuinely involved in taking upon himself this event voluntarily, then the crucifixion would have another meaning entirely. If it happened unknowingly, without his consciousness, if it happened against his will, it would have an entirely different meaning. And then you have this whole matter of the body and blood, which helps you to interpret the crucifixion in terms of the new covenant. You say, here is the sacrificial ritual, as it were, sacrificial event, which solemnizes as the sacrificial event of Genesis 15 solemnized, the old covenant, solemnizes a new binding commitment which God makes to the whole world. Not merely now to Abraham and to his descendants, although that's interpreted spiritually ultimately in the New Testament, but now a new covenant which involves the body and blood of Christ and which ultimately includes the whole world. So to understand this as this is the blood of my covenant, as a new covenant, of course, give this an entirely different meaning from what it might have had if you look at it simply as the killing of a particular man by particular people for particular reasons. It certainly merges in this whole unit. So there are many ways in which this kind of thing is significant. And by the way, also this whole matter of his foreknowing the future, which indicates, again, transcendence. Human beings don't ordinarily foresee the future, you see. So there is a miraculous element involved in this that I think underlines the person of Christ in these events, even these events involving the Passion. And is quite in line with what we have in this whole latter unit of his ministry, namely that he foresaw the Passion and moved toward the cross with a complete awareness of the fact that he would be crucified. All right. Now let's get a second element before us here. Thank you, Dennis. I wonder if you would help us with regard to another major rock with it here. Mitchell Pierce, you do this one. Okay. All right.
Another lot that I saw was continuation of Jesus' death.
All right. I would urge you not to use continuation, as I think I indicated at the outset. For the simple reason that I found that students, particularly at the beginning level of this kind of thing, tend to use continuation rather generally as over against getting behind it, because continuation is rather a general law. Usually there's some specific form of the law that you really ought to get at. So what's behind the continuation?
I struggle between calling it continuation.
Yes, yes, and that's here. I'm not doubting that it's here, you see. Here again is the question as to whether that is a general description of something which is more specific and more precise by way of describing connections here. Now, continuity would be involved, recurrence would be involved, but there's the recurrence of what with regard to the crucifixion? You don't merely have a series of events which talk about crucifixion, do you? What's the relationship here? What's the movement here in terms of this motif, which is discussed extensively and recurs? What's involved in the movement? Yes. What do you have in mind by the interrogation?
For instance, the anointing, why was the one in the best place to, and then the three five. And the path over where we had that skill, kind of pass over.
Now, the question there would be whether you have something that's primary in the structure of the entire unit, or whether you don't have secondary elements that are incidental in the way in which particular events are structured, but don't really structure the unit as a whole. So that's the kind of question you have to ask with regard to distinguishing between a primary relationship and a secondary relationship. Well, let me indicate what's here, and it's bound up with another law, which, and usually we take these in relation to each other, but because this other one, which I'll have on the overhead in just a moment, so it's no secret, this other one is multifaceted. Let me point out to what I think is behind what you're indicating here, Mitchell, and that is the recurrence of causation. In other words, what you have here is, I want to describe this, is the story of what brought about the crucifixion of Christ. What produced it? Involving a number of elements. Here we've already begun talking about causation here in connection with this preparation, you see. Of course, you have the very beginning, this plot by the chief priests and scribes to arrest him and kill him, which starts a whole series of events. And then Judas joins this thing, says, look, I'll help you carry this whole thing out, you see. A whole series of events which produced the crucifixion. Now, these events are multifaceted. They involve a number of individuals and a number of aspects, including even Jesus, because the event could not have happened, as we pointed out, without his voluntarily taking it on. It seems to be the implication here, you see. So it has many facets, but certainly the primary facet would have to do with the role of the ecclesiastical authorities in this, and the role of a civil authority, namely Pilate. And of course, they're involved in this, betrayal here. They're involved in the arrest here eventually, and they're involved in this ecclesiastical trial, and they're the ones who take Jesus to Pilate, etc. So they're really the chief ones in this whole thing. So one could list all of these, including, as I would say, primarily the following: the religious leaders, as they appear throughout this, Judas and his role with the religious leaders in this whole process, Jesus and his surrender to the will of God in the process, and then the civil authority, namely Pilate. Now, let me just point out a few things here that are very significant in this whole process and which emphasize this dimension of evil that you have here, or injustice, as part of the crucifixion, as a vital part of it, as a matter of fact. Let me emphasize areas in the ecclesiastical trial, beginning with 1453, and then the civil trial in chapter 15, that highlight this kind of thing. Let's begin with verse 55 there in chapter 14, with this ecclesiastical trial before the Sanhedrin, this group of 70 who were the ruling authorities, and who recommended to the civil authorities certain punishments. They could not carry out the capital punishment themselves. They could carry out certain other religious punishments, but not capital punishment. So all they could do was to make a decision and then take that decision to the civil authorities, which they did, of course, in chapter 15. But we're told in 55, now the chief priests and the whole council sought testimony against Jesus to put him to death. In other words, as 14:1, 2 already indicates, they have their verdict before the trial ever begins. This is no trial. This is a mistrial. This is the kangaroo court. I mean, they decide we want him killed, and so they set up this farce of a trial in order to carry out their ulterior motives. Now, note the emphasis in the description of the trial. They couldn't find any one who would testify against Jesus validly. What they did find were many who bore false witness against him, and their witness did not agree. Now, this was a clear violation of Jewish law, because you had to have the agreement of at least two witnesses in order to find a person guilty. And some stood up and bore false witness against him, saying, "We heard him say, I will destroy this temple that is made with hands, and in 3 days I will build another, not made with hands. Yet not even so did their testimony agree." In other words, they couldn't even get these false witnesses to agree with each other. To say nothing about the falseness of their testimony. And the high priest stood up in the midst and asked Jesus, "Have you no answer to make? What is it that these men testify against you?" And he was silent, made no answer again. The high priest asked him, "Are you the Christ, the Son of the Blessed?" And Jesus said, "I am. And you will see the Son of Man sitting at the right hand of power and coming with the clouds of heaven." And the high priest tore his mantle and said, Why do we still need witnesses? Let's do away with witnesses. You can't do away with witnesses in this kind of trial. So he simply makes a statement, "You have heard his blasphemy." Now this is a very interesting kind of statement and charge, because after all, they were expecting the Messiah. And any Messiah who would come would make this kind of statement. Ergo, every Messiah, or any Messiah, is blasphemous. That's what this means. Well, what underlies it is that they're saying, "We don't want you as the Messiah. So we'll make this charge against you. That if some other Messiah, whom we want, comes along, at least whom we think is the Messiah, or when we wanted the Messiah comes along, he'll make the same claim, and we won't say to him, that's blasphemy, we'll say, that's great, you're our man. See? So the whole thing was false, was spurious. And then move to the civil trial. We're going to have to move on here, Burl, if you don't mind. I'd be glad to take your questions personally. I don't want you to take more of these, but I want to point out certain things here that we haven't had time to get at. Let's go to the civil trial. We're told in verse 3, the chief priest accused him of many things. And then Pilate asked Jesus, have you no answer to make? See how many charges they bring against you? But Jesus made no further answer, so that Pilate wondered. And then we're told about this whole Barabbas incident, where you have this man who was clearly a murderer, a revolutionary, and who deserved the death penalty, if anybody did. And beginning with verse 10, we're told, Pilate perceived that it was out of envy that the chief priests had delivered him up. Very interesting. He saw their motive. He saw through their motive. But the chief priests stirred up this crowd. You see how this whole thing is wicked, is evil, is unjust from the word go. The word go here is 14:1-2. They simply made up their minds, we're going to get him killed by any means, by hook or by crook. And it's crook. All right, it's crook that's around. So they stir up this crowd, and what happens? Pilate, instead of really looking at the one who ought to be released on the basis of merits, asks the crowd, what shall I do with a man whom you call the King of the Jews? They cried out again, crucify him. They want Barabbas released. And Pilate said to them, why? What evil has he done? No answer. But they shouted, all the more, crucify him. They didn't make any evil charges against him. What evil was there? He'd done only what was good. So you have trial by the mob, and you have the motive of Pilate exposed in verse 15. So Pilate, wishing to satisfy the crowd, a typical politician, operating on the basis of expediency. Not right, not justice, but expediency. Wishing to satisfy the crowd, released for them Barabbas. Having scourged Jesus, he delivered him to be crucified. So, this makes very clear, and we've really been answering the questions that we need to ask about this. This makes really clear what caused the crucifixion. Not any unjust, wicked, unlawful acts on the part of Jesus, not in the true sense, but rather the ulterior motives of both religious and civil authorities. In addition to others who are involved here, such as Judas, who had his own reasons for wanting to betray Christ. And this causation, by the way, relates to the climax, which we'll come to in a sense. We've singled it out here because I want to highlight this. Question, what caused the crucifixion of Jesus? That's the observational question. What was involved in the causes? We've been answering these questions already. How and why did these result in the crucifixion? Why are these causes emphasized? Why recurringly? And what are their full implications? What we've said, I think, indicates that the gospel writer wants to make it very clear that the crucifixion was caused by evil, by wickedness, by injustice, and not by anything which was genuinely done by Jesus, or not by anything which was based on a legal and a just process of trial. Well, let me indicate now very quickly, because our time is going, third relationship that's found here, and that is the relationship of the recurrence and contrast. There's a third law which is here, and this is more implicit. It becomes explicit at certain points, but it's more implicit. And particularly is this true with regard to the biographical element, because we have a whole slew of people involved in these events. You have the religious leaders, you have this woman, you have these disciples, including Judas, etc. You have various people involved in these events. And, of course, you have Jesus, who is the key character here. And what you have, essentially, is a contrast between how Jesus faced these events, although there are others who are put in a good light, such as the woman who anoints him with this very, very costly ointment, and Joseph of Arimathea, this member of the Sanhedrin. That's very interesting now. This man apparently saw through all the fakeness of what was happening here and all the evil, and he took it upon himself with great courage and at great risk to bury Jesus. You have a few that are put in a good light, but basically it is Jesus over against all the others involved here in what someone has called the crucible of the cross. And what the author wants you to see, as we indicate by these questions, what was the meaning of the various actions and the events we reported, what character traits are emphasized concerning the persons involved, what differences are stressed, especially between Jesus and the others involved, why do the persons involved act as they did, why are the biographical differences stressed, why recurringly, what are the implications. What you have here is a great contrast between Jesus and others. And by way of answering some of these questions, this by way of emphasizing the transcendence of Jesus, even in his passion. Now, I think in answering these questions, one has to get behind what the early church was facing and what these gospel writers were facing with regard to trying to set forth the good news of Christ in such a way so as to be acceptable to their hearers. And what they were facing was what the New Testament calls the scandal of the cross. And that was a universal scandal, both to Jews and to Gentiles. Now, Gentiles, I think, are primarily involved with it in terms of this gospel, but it involved both groups. And Paul puts it beautifully in 1 Corinthians 1, 22-24, for Jews demand signs and Greeks seek wisdom, but we preach Christ crucified, a stumbling block to Jews and folly to Gentiles, but to those who are called, both Jews and Greeks, Christ, the power of God and the wisdom of God. So what was needed was an apologia, an apology for the cross. I use apology in terms of defense. Now, one of the ways in which all the gospel writers defend the cross is to show the transcendence of Christ over others. I mean, he's the one that emerges as the shining figure in all this. Everybody else, including his closest disciples, are put in a very bad light, aren't they? Just think of Judas and Peter and the rest of them, with the possible exception of these women, who are, however, looking from afar. May have significance. But they're put in a bad light, so that what happens is that what begins as a scandal, as ignominy, as a shameful event for the Messiah, becomes, in the last analysis, a glorious event. So that you have a climax here involving several events,
the rending of the veil of the temple in 1538, I should say, and then this confession of a centurion which surpasses Peter's confession. Peter's confession was made before Jesus announced his crucifixion. And of course, what Peter does here is deny that he's a disciple of Christ. And here this centurion, a Roman, by the way, a Gentile, looking at how Jesus died. Here's a man who probably witnessed all kinds of crucifixions. Looking at how Jesus died, looked up at his face and said, "Truly, this man was the Son of God." Because of how he died. See the transcendence, the element of transcendence here. And I wish we had the time to make a character study. Because what emerges here is a glorious figure who is indeed Son of God, Son of Man. So that what Jesus indicated at the very beginning of this whole unit, namely that it is because of who he is, the Son of Man, that he must suffer and be killed. That is to say, his passion is an expression of his person. He is supported by the passion events themselves. And by the way, he uses Son of Man, you recall, in answer to the question of the chief priest regarding his identification. And by the way, this motif of Son of Man involves two emphases, and they're both included here in the crucifixion narrative. On the one hand, humiliation, passion, suffering, ignominy, shame, but on the other hand, exaltation. And by the way, you note that he emphasizes the exaltation motif here in connection with this answer to the question of the priest, because he says, I am, and you will see the Son of Man sitting at the right hand of power and coming with the clouds of heaven. By the way, both of those motifs are found in 8:31 to 9:1. That's the unit that we studied. Now, by the way, the crucifixion itself is part of this climax, and I think even the burial by Joseph of Arimathea is part of this whole climax here, indicating his recognition that this man was not the man who was charged as a criminal by the ecclesiastical authorities and by the civil authorities, by the Sanhedrin of which he was a member, but rather he was the one that he claimed to be.
Is he a member of the same council as seen there in 53 through whatever?
Right.
He's a member. So he was probably there, you think?
Yes. And he was saying that this whole thing was wrong by his courageous burial of Christ. Okay, you want me to put, let me just put this transparency on as far as strategic areas are concerned, for those of you who are interested here. I would say that these are some of the most strategic areas, and I've indicated some of the reasons involved here. They're really bound up with these elements. Elements of preparation and realization, for example, the Jesus' interpretation of the passion there, and then causation, Jesus' decision regarding the cross and these mistrials, and elements of climax. So they're bound up with, they represent the operation of these laws. And oh, yes, I'm sorry. Yes, I forgot to announce that. Yes, we'll be here at 12 o'clock at noon. We'll talk about it. Okay, many thanks. Leave your papers as you go out, if you will, please. Thank you very much.
Contrast interchange.